Hey everyone, this is Cameron from Renegade Animation on renegadepopculture.com. If you like what we do, please give us a like, a follow, and a rating, and make sure to share out our episodes on Apple Podcast or wherever you listen to us. We are everywhere. If you can, consider supporting our Patreon. That way we can keep doing what we love, and that's talking about Kung Fu Panda. And now, on with the show.
What's going on, everyone? Welcome to another episode of Renegade Animation on the Renegade Pop Culture Podcast Network. My name is Mike. I'll be your host this evening. Joining me, as always, is the animation guru himself, Cameron.
Howdy, howdy.
And yeah, this is the episode where we get to talk about Kung Fu Panda 4 and its relationship to the Kung Fu Panda series as a whole. But before we get there, we had a pretty eventful evening or weekend, for better or for worse. Unfortunately, we have to start with the worse. We heard late on Thursday night, on March 1st, we lost Akira Toriyama at the age of 68 to acute subdural hematoma. He had a private funeral with his family. Yeah, pretty much all of last weekend, we heard nothing but kind stories from pretty much the entire internet mourning the loss of the creator of Dragon Ball and Dr. Slump and so much more in the worlds of anime, manga, and video games.
Exactly. If you're making a Mount Rushmore of influential creatives, you of course have Hayao Miyazaki, Osamu Tezuka, Katsuhiro Otomo, and Akira Toriyama, who made one of the most, probably the most influential anime of all time with Dragon Ball. Like, I know there's others like Gundam and Sailor Moon, but none of them quite hit it out of the park like Dragon Ball did.
And not only that, but Dragon Ball was that sort of the nexus point for where anime would explode during the late 90s throughout the 2000s, that being on Toonami in the US.
I mean, there's a lot we could go over with the Dragon Ball franchise, from the original series that started it all to Dragon Ball Z, the subsequent movies, the video games, and all of the shows and references that showed up in other shows because of how much of an impact Dragon Ball left on the entertainment industry. Other anime would not exist without Dragon Ball. And not only that, but Dragon Quest, the popular RPG franchise, would probably not be here today if it didn't have not only the creatives behind it, but the amazing artwork that Akira Toriyama provided for the franchise. And the 100% iconic slime design.
Yes.
You cannot say there was a more impactful franchise with Dragon Quest as an RPG series. I mean, outside of Final Fantasy and Wizardry, but the art style was a big part of it because you just never saw an RPG that looked like the stuff that Akira Toriyama came up with. And as much as I wish we could go into a more proper tribute to him, we are going to have to wait until the Sandland series and the film get released to talk more about Akira Toriyama as a creative individual, of his combination of silly antics, epic action, and memorable characters. And that's just talking about some of the stuff that most people know about. There are other one-offs and series that Akira Toriyama had his hand in helping create that we just would not know about without him. Chrono Trigger, one of the most influential RPGs of the 90s, was also elevated because of the incredible art style from Akira Toriyama. Like, it's hard to find so many people in the creative industry that could leave such a Yamcha-sized crater impact as Akira Toriyama.
Yep. And as I said on Twitter a couple days ago, everybody has a Toriyama story, even if they don't realize it. He has affected so much in the world of pop culture.
It's funny because I have not watched the Dragon Ball and Dragon Ball Z series in forever, but I can still recollect all of the plot points that happened. It's that franchise that I could just pull a random story beat out of. That's what happened in this episode. Rest in peace, Akira Toriyama. You will be sorely missed as a creative in the force of art. There's no other good transitional way to talk about this next topic, so we're going to talk about the just quickly about the Oscars, since they just happened. Barring the overall discussion of the Oscars, like quality and the dialogue and the winners, G-Kids and Hayao Miyazaki took home the Oscar for Best Animated Feature. Studio Ghibli now has two Oscars under their belt, and G-Kids, after 14 or so nominations, finally have their big victory award win. And not just for the Annies either. They have an Oscar. Not that it means more than the others, but it's a big friggin' deal.
It is a big deal. It's also a big deal because of the competition that it was up against.
It's just impressive because it was a latecomer to the release windows. I mean, I got to see it in October, but most people got to see it in December. And then in Japan, of course, they saw it in July. I think it was July. Then, with it going against Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse and Nimona, like, it was kind of tough to know what was going to win in terms of the best animated feature, because we had Elemental, Robot Dreams, Nimona, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, and then The Boy and the Heron. And the Academy doesn't always have the best reaction to anime, but they have loved Miyazaki in the past. Not enough to give him an award at any other point, but they still nominate him. Like, they still loved him enough to nominate Ghibli and such, but it's interesting how very few times they are able to actually win. Like, even in weaker years, they still couldn't win. I think they should have won in 2014 with the Tales of Princess Kaguya instead of Big Hero 6, but it also had to go against Song of the Sea, and I love that movie too.
Yeah, that was a tough year.
And then 2015, when Marnie was there, could have won, probably should have won, but it was also going against Shaun the Sheep movie, The Boy in the World, and the reason why it didn't win, Inside Out, was the big triumphant return after Pixar was hitting a low point in their career. Just to see Miyazaki win again, and to be the one director to have two 2D animated films win the Best Animated Feature Award is astounding. Kind of wish they were nominated for other things like Joe Hisaishi for the incredible musical score and to be nominated for Best Picture, but the Academy is going to Academy. So we will just have to keep taking the victories in small strides. But this is a very big deal. Also, a fun fact how Godzilla winning Best Visual Effects means that two different Lupin the Third directors have won Oscars now.
Now that is cool.
Very cool. Japan and other countries took home a lot of the awards this year, and it's very shocking that they did, because that usually doesn't happen, because the Oscars are so US bound and They still love stuff like Maestro. Congrats to Studio Ghibli. Congrats to Hayao Miyazaki. Congrats to G Kids. I hope this means that G Kids will keep on winning. And so far, they have a few films coming out this year where they could absolutely win, depending on how people react to Inside Out 2 and Moana 2.
Yeah, I'm very interested in seeing what this year has to offer, not just in terms of awards, but just how both Disney and a competition is received by audiences and critics. This is going to be a very interesting year.
Because 2 years in a row now, Disney has lost the Best Animated Feature Oscar, which is usually what they were always going to win because the Oscars are screened on ABC, and also the award members do things like love Disney too much or let their kids vote for the Oscars, like for this category, instead of the actual voters taking the animation brand seriously. Which, what have you had to say about Jimmy Kimmel? Kudos on him for calling that out. And kudos for the film winning being PG-13.
Yes, that I thought was pretty cool. And the fact that Jimmy Kimmel that night called out both lazy voters who let their kids pick the winner for Best Animated Feature, and also kind of throwing shade at the Directors Guild for taking that deal while the writers and actors went on strike.
Oh yeah, no, he bluntly said y'all folded quickly. And though granted, I think he should have thrown more shade at the Actors Guild because of how their deal is not actually all that great for everyone else outside of the A-listers. Alas, again, victory in small steps. Because for the longest time, the only way you could win against Disney in Best Animated Feature was if they had an off year. And either the tides are turning and Disney is absolutely losing its power, or the voters are just getting sick and tired of Disney thinking they're on top of the mountain when they are no longer doing that. They are no longer on top of the mountain. Everyone else has been making or crafting experiences that are performing better for the most part than their usual output.
Even when Disney was on top of the mountain circa like 2013, we were still starting to see other studios rising to the occasion. Now it just feels a lot more equal than it was probably even like 20 years ago.
The thing about Disney is that they are playing it safe. They are not letting their creatives cook, and their films are suffering for it. Elemental got very lucky that it became a long game victory because otherwise they could have easily entered into the Academy Award system this year with no nominations in the animation category. I think they are very lucky that Poor Things got nominated and won as many times as it did. Because there was no way Wish was going to win. Even Elemental's long game was not going to beat Nimona or Spider-Verse. To see other studios come out on top is very healthy for the industry.
Agreed.
Because what you need is something like the upcoming The Wild Robot. Or, since we're here, let's talk about the Kung Fu Panda franchise, which has usually been, at least for me, I know it can fluctuate between How to Train Your Dragon and this franchise. But even with what we have to say about Kung Fu Panda 4, the Kung Fu Panda franchise is, to me, the best franchise that DreamWorks has. It has the better TV shows. It has the better movies. I'm not going to talk about the games, but in terms of multiple movies, The Kung Fu Panda franchise is the one I rewatch the most.
I think for me, I really do flip-flop between Kung Fu Panda and How to Train Your Dragon. I think as far as strictly the movies, the Kung Fu Panda films, even to a lesser extent, four have been the most consistent in terms of story, Po's character development. The fact that James Hong has been involved in every single project from the movies to the TV shows is kind of impressive. And the fact that he's like 95 years old, but still sounds spry and energetic.
It's a franchise that on paper, and everyone says this, on paper sounds really stupid. To DreamWorks' credit, they are very good at taking really weird and silly ideas and crafting very fun experiences out of them. That's been kind of their secret weapon and is why they have basically become more favorable. Despite the fact people keep on a very inconsistent basis trashing them because, oh, the next movie you're making is not Puss in Boots: The Last Wish quality, which we'll talk a little bit about that when we talk about the Megamind stuff in 2 weeks. Because with Kung Fu Panda, it was a perfect encapsulation of comedy, action, and storytelling that took some very risky directions, including the fact that the first film was very much not a chosen one story. It was very much against that, where granted the future films would kind of retcon that, where Po was always going to be the chosen one to Oogway, but they wrote themselves on the corner with that one. So I don't blame them for that. But they make up for it with some of the best storytelling and animation, and also some of the best comedy. So obviously, when we are talking about this in such high regard, we were looking forward to Kung Fu Panda 4. There were definitely some worries because instead of having the director from the last two, Jennifer Yu Nelson, back, we had Mike Mitchell back in the director seat, who a lot of people would know more as the director of Trolls and the Lego Movie sequel. So this was one of the first kind of things that we should have maybe expected with Kung Fu Panda 4, that it was going to be more comedy based, which, if you compare these to like Jackie Chan experiences, then that's not really a shock because Kung Fu Panda is this loving homage to Kung Fu cinema. Well, one of the biggest names in Kung Fu and martial arts cinema was Jackie Chan, and Jackie Chan's biggest strength were how his films would balance comedy, stunts, and action bits. And you could see that through all four of these movies that feel like, oh, someone binged watched all of Jackie Chan's movies and took the best elements from the action sequences and put them into the movie. And sometimes the movie's comedy was very funny. Some of it doesn't age well for Jackie Chan, but for Kung Fu Panda, they've used a more American comedic sensibility for their films. But as we went from Kung Fu Panda 1 being like a surprisingly good movie, the second film became more in depth with its world and character building. We had the best villain of the franchise with Lord Shen.
Easily the best, and still my
We,
favorite.
yeah, no, I think everyone agrees that Lord Shen is like the top tier DreamWorks villain, then with some of the most heartfelt, impactful story beats of any DreamWorks movie, including the flashback to when Po's dad found Po, and then the moment where Po reaches inner peace of dealing and accepting with what happened to his past and to his mother. It's just a combination of great writing, great directing, and amazing visuals. Like, you get very heartfelt and like torn seeing these movies. And it's a movie about Jack Black playing a panda that knows Kung Fu. How does that even work? Like, it's amazing how these movies came out. And even if the third one maybe took a step back with General Kai, who is still a great villain, but not as good as Lord Shen, you still found moments where it's so personal and intimate, touching with how they connect family and the bonds that Po has crafted with the people in the Panda Village and with characters from the previous films. So, yeah, expectations were high going into Kung Fu Panda 4. And I still like the movie. I still think it's a solid movie. Something is very much missing from the overall experience of Kung Fu Panda 4.
And no, we're not just talking about the lack of the Furious Five.
Even though that this movie kind of threw the nail in the coffin of, oh, they really don't care about the Furious Five. They brought him back for like 1 2-minute scene at the very end. It's the fact that this movie is missing a lot of the soul and charm of the previous three films. And I think that is because having Mike Mitchell on took the franchise into the wrong direction. And it sucks because I don't want to say it's all his fault because a lot of stuff goes on behind the production of an animated feature. It's not always just one person to use as a scapegoat. But if the floating around interview with the co-director is to be believed, and you shouldn't unless the co-director comes out and says, some of this is true, some of this is exaggerated, some of this is false, take with a grain of salt. Because why do you think this film didn't hit the stride of the previous three films, Mike?
I would say it's because the DNA of the film just feels off. Even the way the movie opens, it doesn't open the same way. Like, you know how the first three will begin with like some sort of story, a shift in art style that cuts right to Ho or one of the other characters. Just right from the beginning, it starts off different. It starts with the teasing of Tai Lung's return, but then we find out later, obviously, that it's just the chameleon. But still, just from that opening, and then on top of the Furious Five being absent, and the villain sort of being sort of like a different approach to storytelling, everything feels just a little off kilter. Still overall an enjoyable movie, but you know something different. And I guess that kind of is a little bit appropriate since one of the themes about this movie is it's all about change and how it can be scary, but sort of a necessary part of life.
I think the biggest problem with Kung Fu Panda's story is not the themes, because I agree. I think the theme of change and how, like, you need to accept that change is good in the world. The problem is the movie has a lighter tone to it. It's more incentive on being funny than being a good balance of comedy and heart. And I'm not going to say that Kung Fu Panda loses its entire heart, but the execution and pacing of the story leave a lot of the more interesting ideas still flat on the ground. They don't rise up to the occasion. Like, for example, the chameleon, voiced wonderfully by Viola Davis. Great idea for a villain, a chameleon that also symbolizes change by being a literal shapeshifter, stealing and taking the powers of martial arts masters because no one would teach her. But in execution, she is a more mediocre General Kai.
I was going to say, yeah, like you said, the execution of her evil scheme, it does seem like a repeat of Kai.
I think a lot of this is because the actual stealing of the martial arts stuff happens way too late in the movie. This needed to be our first introduction to the chameleon, not shapeshifting as Tai Lung, but as she is taking the powers away from everyone. In some way, this could have been a very interesting movie. What if Po, instead of teaming up with just Awkwafina's Zen, this fox thief, what if Po teamed up with Tai Lung to take down the chameleon and to put his soul back into the spirit realm to rest? Instead of just like the problem is, this movie introduces a lot of interesting details in the story, but
And then
then
just kind of
do
rushes through them.
exactly. I love Ian McShane as Tai Lung, and Tai Lung is still probably second to the bottom of memorable villains for Kung Fu Panda. But compared to the Chameleon, who is just named the Chameleon, he is way more interesting. And a lot of that is because of Ian McShane's performance. They do not bring back Lord Shen or General Kai's voice actors, Gary Oldman and J.K. Simmons. Apparently, they were supposedly last-minute additions because why else would you bring back Tai Lung, but not the other martial art villains of the previous films? And then we get stuff like Zen's connections to the underground Den of Thieves area. Like, we get a fun, delightful appearance from Ke Huy Quan as Han, this pangolin leader of the Den of Thieves. But again, they just kind of introduce him and then don't do as much with him or give him a stronger bond to Zen than just, oh, we were waiting and willing to turn you in to the chameleon, when it then turns out that Zen worked for the chameleon.
It's not a bad twist that Jen was working for the Chameleon. It's just another example of this movie throwing a little bit too much on the plate without giving each of these ideas room to breathe.
The other problem with the story is that it had to really regress some elements of the movie. On one hand, I love that the pandas are now a part of the Jade City or whatever the main location is in the franchise. I love that we get to see Bryan Cranston back as Lee and James Hong as Mr. Ping. But to have them as the comedic side characters of the movie, and I can't believe I'm saying this, I rather them been joining Jack Black and Awkwafina's from the get-go instead of afterwards, because it felt like they needed something to do because they weren't going to bring back the Furious Five, so they brought back the two dads, and their antics were very inconsistent and sometimes better than the antics from the main plot line. Part of me is like, I kind of want to see more of Mr. Ping and Lee Shan and their antics. I loved their interactions, like at the tea house and
Yeah.
such. But it also felt like they regressed their characters too. Like they still had to bicker back and forth between one another and be like, I'm the better dad at points. And Lee Shan having to be the cowardly one compared to his son. Again, it's very weird where they take these characters. And I think that's just, again, a focus on the comedy. And the comedy is fine. I laughed a couple times, but even in my full theater watching of this movie, there wasn't much laughing to be had. And I think it's because the jokes just weren't hitting this time around. They try to have some comedy with the chameleon, like the blood moon coming over the temple and just being like, man, it's taking forever. What's taking so long? It's just for pizzazz. And then starts the summoning ritual. Like, that could be funny, but it also reminded me of how Lord Shen worked as a villain and with the comedy of Lord Shen.
I still think one of the funniest jokes from Kung Fu Panda 2 is when Po confronts him towards the end of the movie. They're like miles apart, and Shen's like, "What? I can't hear you."
Yeah, Poe's doing his epic return speech, and then it cuts to Lord Shannon. You could barely hear Poe, and Shannon's just like, "What?" I love like when Shin brings the cannon back. It's like, I have been waiting for my return here for years, so I imagine the cannon to the left. Perfect. Now with this weapon, buy my a little bit more, and that's the thing. It just doesn't hit the high points of Kung Fu Panda. Even the action is not as good as it could have been. There's one moment that I liked where Po punches his way out of a cage by going down a floor level. And there's this cool, like, shadow fight where you see Po fighting in the dark with, like, a soft glow in the background with the dust from all the rubble.
That was a cool scene. I love the way they animated the silhouettes fighting. That one probably one of the highlights as far as like the action goes.
But the rest of the action is just like we've seen better before. We have three movies that have done the action set pieces better. The tavern fight, seen it done better. The final fight against the chameleon, I really did not like the fact that they made the chameleon a giant beast at one point. It just felt so generic. Of, like, an action movie. Oh, you gotta fight the big bad thing. At least in The Croods: to New Age, it made sense that the monkeys were giving tribute of the bananas to this giant baboon that was threatening over them. Why not just keep the chameleon human size, or, well, human size in terms of what is the normal height of villains in the Kung Fu Panda franchise?
Right.
The other side characters just weren't interesting either. You had the mischievous bunnies that they were very much relying on for marketing to be like the comedic high point. They're very generic comedy characters. Just, oh, look how cute they are. Oh no, they're vicious.
They were pretty one note. I did actually like the fish and the pelican.
Yeah, Ronnie Cheng plays Captain Fish, a arowana that was living in the pelican's mouth. But even then, there were like little jokes that are like, okay, we get it. Zen is, who's played by Awkwafina, is going to be the next dragon warrior. And it's weird how this franchise treats Po's label as dragon warrior as something that could be easily taken away. Like with Kung Fu Panda and Dragon Knight. Because of an incident that he was not able to stop, it's like, now we're going to take your Dragon Warrior title away. And it's like, the guy messed up once. It could have been a lot worse for y'all, all things considered. It's just weird how flippant they are with saying, like, Po cannot be the Dragon Warrior. And listen, I wasn't a big fan of the Mr. Beast cameo, but he's in there for like 2 seconds. And the joke is decent, even though the third movie did it better and already did that joke where a pig is colored like Po and it does the whole impersonation skadoosh thing. And I think really like the newest joke that I liked were the inner voices sequences.
I really like that too.
I love the ones where Master Shifu is in Po's mind and they both agree with talking down to Po, and then at the end of the movie, they pay him back with all of the Po's inner voices talking to him at once. It's like you will never know inner peace. But even then, it's Kung Fu Panda wrote itself into a corner with Po not being a chosen one at first, but then having to be the chosen one. So if this means we're going to get a Kung Fu Panda 5 since before being royally kicked out, Katzenberg was going to do 6 movies in the Kung Fu Panda franchise. And it's tough to do that when the third film feels like it wraps everything up and is like a great ending to the story of Po.
That's exactly what I thought coming out of the third movie back in 2016. I'm like, wow, this is a really nice, rock solid trilogy. I have no idea what they're gonna do for a new trilogy after this. And again, I want to stress that I did enjoy this movie quite a bit, but I'm not sure how this is going to kick off a new trilogy.
Like, they would have to actually take the story in new directions. And barring the fact that Dustin Hoffman is not the greatest person, get rid of Shifu. Put him in the background. Don't use him anymore. There needs to be a progression of time for this franchise to work now, because are we going to see Zen again? Is she going to be the actual Dragon Warrior? Is Po going to be in the background now? Because you can't call it Kung Fu Panda.
Without the Kung Fu Panda.
So they write themselves into a corner with this franchise at times. Are you going to bring back the Furious Five? Because it seems like y'all don't really care. It's like they had them for the first and second movie and the TV show. But then when the Amazon series happened, and with the third film pushing them away more, it's like they did not care about them as characters, which is a problem with DreamWorks. They like to build up big casts, but then do nothing with them at times, which is, an Illumination problem also. But we'll talk about Illumination when we see Despicable Me 4. They would need to do something like bring back the Furious Five for a movie. Let Po and Shin go off on an adventure or something against with the Furious Five, against like a retooling or reworking of the Dragon Knight plot line. Like, you could deal with stuff like colonialism or something like that, of like this European force in like knights and such coming into China to show them, I don't know, armor and swords are better than kung fu. I mean, granted, that's kind of the plot of Lord Shen's plan of using cannons and gunpowder to take down kung fu. I have like a few ideas, but they're very much elevator pitch ideas. I enjoyed this movie as well, but it's like the more I linger with it, the more I'm just not sure if I do really like this movie. And that sucks because I do like the movie. But it continues to land on the bottom because they're also not giving time to let anything simmer. Or again, I just don't like the fact that Po fights something big at the end. The appeal of the Kung Fu Panda franchise is the fact that the fights were very much humanoid animal versus humanoid animal. No, I'm going to fight a dragon or something like that. Like the beginning fight with the Stingray.
That was good.
That was good, but was that Stingray like not a living being? Like, could they not talk or something? Or is, I don't know. Now I'm getting to that nitpicky stuff, and I don't want to get into that because that's not what matters. What matters is the fact that Kung Fu Panda 4 suffers from a real missing heart piece, and I don't want to gatekeep who directs these movies, but I think you really have to give it back to Jennifer Yu Nelson.
I would have to
She.
agree with that.
Even when with her non Kung Fu Panda work, she has shown to be an amazing director who knows how to balance comedy, heart, and action. I mean, we saw what she could do with Love, Death, and Robots. Her shorts were usually some of the better ones of that anthology series. Or, bring back the Puss in Boots: The Last Wish duo. And I don't want to come off like I'm being too hard on Mike Mitchell. I just don't think this was the right project for him. It's kind of like how the CGI Berserk series came out, and the director was more known for high kinetic comedies than big, broody action, dark fantasy stuff. Not every director can direct certain genres, and that's okay.
Not everyone is going to excel at the same things. I will say I do commend Mitchell for maybe stepping out of his comfort zone, still leaning more towards comedy than some of the more serious aspects of the Kung Fu Panda franchise. But still, I think the heart of this series belongs to Jennifer U. Nelson.
And it's just telling when you know the exact thing that was missing from a movie is the director. This happens all the time. Like the Pink Panther films had a moment where they made a film without the main star and the director, and nobody liked the movie. So.
And you want to know the weird thing? All four of these movies have the same pair of writers, Jonathan Abel and Glenn Berger. Four is the only movie where they brought in a third writer who also may or may not have altered the DNA.
Yeah, like I said, the interview that is floating around should be taken with a grain of salt that the two other writers left and this new writer is the reason why this movie feels like it's in a rush to get to the next story beat instead of letting there be time or focus on character. Because DreamWorks has a lot of zany comedies. A lot of their movies are zany comedies. Kung Fu Panda is not just a zany comedy. It's just so much more than just a general DreamWorks animated feature. Yeah, I mean, obviously, our discussion of it is not going to hurt it. It's already made its money back pretty much by this week. So it's doing well. And it was also apparently a film that had help with animation production with Jellyfish Pictures, who also helped with stuff like The Boss Baby, Family Business, The Bad Guys, and Spirit Untamed. We'll have to see because this will also be one of the last two films that is made in-house at DreamWorks because DreamWorks has decided to do the questionable thing and is now outsourcing its animation to outside studios in a decision to try to save money, but also to work around the fact that this year is the animation strike. And let's just say the fact that some outside studios are already unionizing is not going to work in this decision-making favor for them.
Oh, of course
But,
not.
like, listen, I love the other studios that are making stuff for the US animation scene. But let's not act like US-based studios cannot do the same thing as like the studio that helped do the TMNT Mutants Mayhem visual style. That stuff takes time and money, and you cannot overwork your animators to get that. You don't have to. It's just this movie represents a lot of interesting things to discuss about DreamWorks that I want to get into more with the Megamind stuff that we'll talk about next time. So, if you for some reason haven't seen this film and you want to or are questioning if you want to, give it a watch. It's still good in general, but I've seen a few movies already that are still better than it. And I think the only reason I put it above Mabaroshi in my animation ranking is because I still enjoy watching it and can watch it any time compared to the more heavier Mabaroshi.
Yeah, that's the thing. I've already seen this movie twice, and I may or may not see it if I have the time. It's an easy watch. It's an enjoyable one. The better DreamWorks movie that came out this year so far is Orion in the Dark on Netflix. If you still haven't seen that movie, you should watch that one as soon as you can.
I just think it is the better movie so far. And it's this small, quote unquote, unassuming Netflix original movie, but it has the heart that Kung Fu Panda 4 is missing. We'll just have to see what happens. I hope the people who make these movies keep their jobs or are able to and are still able to go and make and craft amazing things. And if we do get Kung Fu Panda 5 and 6, I hope they are more adventurous than this, because this almost felt like a Disney production, like a current one, where they played it a bit too safe storytelling wise. So I want to see them do more, because that's kind of been the strength of DreamWorks, is that they are able to go above and beyond what Disney is allowing their artists to not do. So we'll just have to see. But next time, we are going to do a podcast focusing on the New York International Children's Film Festival. And we got a handful of movies to talk about, and I can't wait to talk about two of my favorite movies of the year so far.
Yeah, I am very much looking forward to the selection for this year's film festival. But until next time, Cameron, where can everyone find you online?
You can find me on Twitter and Blue Sky at Cam's Eye View. I have an Instagram that's Cam's Eye View as well. I have a website called camseyeview.biz where I review animated films and shows from around the world called The Other Side of Animation. I also have a Patreon at patreon.com/camseyeview.
And you guys can find me on various social media sites at Captain K42. You can check out my quick thoughts on letterboxd.com/CoachK42. And you can follow Renegade Pop Culture on Facebook and that place at Ren Pop Culture. You can also find us on YouTube, on Podchaser. Subscribe to our Patreon at patreon.com/RenegadePopCulture. Listen to all of our podcasts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen. And last but not least, everything can be found at renegadepopculture.com. Need an escape? So do we. That'll do it for this episode of Renegade Animation. We will catch you guys later. Peace out.